It is 8:06. Good morning. It is Thursday, August 13th. You are listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW Park City. I'm Grace Dorfler, filling in for Leslie Thatcher as your host this morning. It is 56 degrees and overcast in Park City. Quite a bit of rain in the forecast. 61 degrees and cloudy in the Heber Valley with a high of 80 degrees. ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes has details on the weather outlook.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back, and we're going to be looking at off and on periods of showers and thunderstorms as we go throughout the day. Temperatures will climb into the lower 70s in the Park City area. We'll see those highs climbing to around 80 degrees in the Heber Valley. As we make our way into Friday, expect more good chances of scattered showers and thunderstorms, and that will continue to hold these temperatures well below average. High temperatures only in the low to mid 70s in Park City. We'll see those highs as we go into your Friday, only around 80 again in the Heber Valley. As we move into the upcoming weekend, we'll be calling it partly cloudy skies. Overall, drier air will begin to filter in. There's still going to be a chance of a pop-up storm, mainly across the mountains as we go into your Saturday. But for most of us, it's looking mainly dry. And then by Sunday, I think definitely a dry day. Temperatures start to creep back up. We're talking upper 70s as we get you into Park City. High temperatures will climb back into the mid-80s. Around the Heber Valley by Sunday. As we move into early next week, well, it's overall looking mainly dry. Partly cloudy skies expected for your Monday, Tuesday, and for your Wednesday. There will be a slight chance of a pop-up storm. That chance will be the greatest, and it's still going to be slight, but that chance will be the greatest by the time we get towards your Wednesday. I think a better chance, though, ramping up by next Thursday and Friday as we get another surge of monsoon moisture in here. But between Monday and Wednesday, just very slim chances, partly cloudy skies, but temperatures will start to warm back up. So we'll warm back into the low 80s in Park City as we head into next week, and we'll see those highs back into the mid to upper 80s in the Heber Valley. That's still a degree or two below average for this time of the year. So below average temperatures are expected, but watch out for that elevated threat of flash flooding as we go throughout the next couple of days, as we see several periods of showers and storms, not a complete washout throughout the day, but we will have some waves of showers and storms that will impact us as we go throughout your Thursday and Friday. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Taking a look at the traffic across the Wasatch Back. In Summit County, traffic looks relatively clear across the region. Not too many slowdowns to report on Interstate 80. You might see a little bit of delays if you are driving west into Park City on State Route 248. In Wasatch County, drivers might experience some traffic around the intersection of US 40 and River Road that's headed northbound out of town. There's also a little bit of traffic around the Deer Creek Reservoir area on US 189. And as a reminder, farther north in Summit County, Highways 65 and 66 remain closed due to the Rocky Canyon fire. We will have more updates on that fire in just a few minutes. I want to give listeners an overview of the show that we have planned this morning. We will start off the hour with U.S. Forest Service Fire Incident Manager Sierra Hellstrom. She has an update on the Rocky Canyon fire burning in Morgan and Summit counties. Then Midway City Council Member Kevin Payne joins the show to talk about affordable housing in Midway and some projects that the city is taking on. And then finally, Summit County Council Member Candace Hart has a recap of a joint meeting last night between the Summit County and Wasatch County Councils. That is all coming up in the Local News Hour. And as a reminder, Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW. Then after that, stay tuned at 9 o'clock for Cool Science Radio. It's an exploration into the emerging world of predictive medicine and how it could transform the future of care with AI pioneer Anmol Madan. Then, what if you could practice a high-stakes job without the real-world risk? Nick Day explains how virtual reality is transforming workforce training and helping employers know when workers are truly ready. That is all coming up on Cool Science Radio right here on KPCW at 9 o'clock. I will have local news headlines for you after this. Summit County is planning to increase services for older residents. And as KPCW's Connor Thomas reports, that could mean more resources outside of senior centers.
Statisticians predict Summit County will have more residents older than 65 than 14 years or younger by the end of this decade. But the aging population is staying young at heart. That's according to consultants that the county hired to plan the future of senior services. For starters, Jordan Polito from the Hill Group says that a lot of older residents don't like the label senior.
One of the refrains we've heard over and over again, particularly talking to individuals who do not yet participate in senior center programs in particular, is that, well, I'm not old enough, right? I may be a senior by definition, but I'm not old enough to go to that place or to participate in those programs.
The growing share of older residents might create more demand for services, but the consultant's draft report indicates there are already others who could benefit from expanded services or programs that are not branded for quote-unquote seniors. The final report won't be ready until the fall, when the Summit County Council begins budgeting for next year.
A critical part of this strategic plan is that it's not about the three physical senior centers only. It's about the ecosystem of services available inside and outside of those senior centers.
Park City Senior Center board member Craig Weekly says that programming supports the mind as well as the body.
Senior centers draw people out of isolation. They engage them with their peers through congregate meals, through communal activities and programming. They build community, which is exactly what these folks need.
The Hill Group is expected to recommend more transportation service to activities and the senior centers in Camas, Park City, and Colville.
There are some incredibly dedicated volunteers who wake up before dawn to provide transportation services to their peers in this community. But what we've heard loud and clear is it's not enough.
Deputy County Manager Jana Young says staff hopes the report will help with 2027 budgeting. Park City Municipal has budgeted for an entirely new senior center, which it wants to finish by 2029. The building will move a couple blocks from Lower Woodside Avenue to the Mawinney parking lot across from the Park City Library. Summit County and Park City Municipal are financial supporters of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
On the phone with an update on the Rocky Canyon fire burning in Morgan and Summit counties is Sierra Hellstrom. Sierra, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for being here. I spoke with you yesterday morning about the Rocky Canyon fire, and I'm curious how things have changed in the last 24 hours and especially overnight. Where are we sitting in terms of acreage and containment?
So we're still at the same acreage that 15,633 was yesterday, and 29% containment. The really good news is, you know, yesterday there had been a little moisture over the fire and over the area, but really wasn't hitting the fire. And last night we got quite a bit.
That's
so
great.
We're really excited about that.
Yeah, I'm sure that really helps firefighters out. And how does the weather fit into firefighting efforts? Is it helping or hurting at this point?
That's a great question, because a lot of times people don't realize it obviously presents its own challenges, especially where we've seen what can happen on a fire scar down on the Cottonwood fire. And this fire didn't burn to that extent and complexity, but there's still potential for some flooding. So for this morning, we're actually keeping crews in camp as it's still sprinkling a little bit to let some of those floodplains play out. And then we'll get out and work closely with the emergency managers to see what areas are safe to go in. But the biggest story really is this won't put the fire out. It's going to help immensely. The moisture will cool areas where there wasn't a lot of vegetation and maybe just a few hot spots, but we likely, as soon as this rain moves out, we'll start to see some of those smokes and flame up on the top of that ridge where the fire's been active.
Okay. I know this has been a particularly hot fire. Are we still seeing some pretty active behavior overnight, or has the rain kind of calmed it down a little bit?
The rain calmed it down quite a bit overnight. They saw very few areas of torching and heat. Still some. Even through the rain, there's still some at that top ridge just to the northeast side of, or the northwest side of Hennifer. And that's what I think a lot of people don't understand, is how much heat that it would take, a lot of firefighting efforts, or like a season-ending rain event to really put this fire out.
Okay. So with that in mind, what's the plan going forward? What are we expecting today and in the coming days?
So we will insert crews in a little while once the rain has slowed down and we feel like there isn't an impact or a danger for any flood issues and putting them up into any unsafe areas. And then moving forward, we probably will see this fire pick back up. Today's the last day of rain and cooler weather, and then we're going back into the high temperatures and high winds and low humidity. So we're going to see a very drastic change in from today to tomorrow. So we're going to try and do everything we can while we have favorable weather to make progress around containment on this fire.
Okay. How do you come up with a strategy for attacking a fire? How do you prioritize?
Priority is always where the values at risk are. And on a fire like this, you know, obviously our communities are one of our values at risk, homes and infrastructure. But another one that, you know, to think about is like, where are our waterways and the water systems that we use, as well as grazing allotments. That's obviously something we want to make sure we prioritize. There's a lot of values at risk here, and we try and work around those and be as minimally impactful as possible while keeping the fire in the smallest box as possible. Mm-hmm. And it's been, have to be really strategic on this fire, especially as it moved up into the cliffs and those rocky areas. It's really difficult to access, and it's not easy to go direct when you've got, you know, 40-foot, 50-foot flame lengths, even during rain. So we're trying to do it safely, but using a lot of tactics between dozer and aircraft, and honestly, boots on the ground is what really gets fires out.
Yeah. Could you tell me a little bit more about what kind of resources and how many firefighters are on the scene right now?
Yeah, we're pushing about just almost 300, and that's with some crews. That's counting some crews we're getting in today. Our biggest need right now on this fire is crews up in that high country that isn't easy to get the heavy equipment to, and it's limited in where it can go. And some of those spots aviation cannot also access easily. So one of the things people think, it's kind of a misnomer, is that aircraft puts fires out. But, you know, water cools a fire and retardant slows a fire. But similar to your campfire, if you just pour some water on a big flaming fire, it's not going to put it out. It's that drowning and stirring and drowning and stirring that puts fire out. And so that's what we're doing right now. You know, we've been drowned in that fire with retardant and water to cool it down and getting firefighters in there to stir that perimeter and slow it down. And thankfully, that's where the rain comes in handy, is we got that drown last night and hopefully through this morning. And then we got to get crews up in there this afternoon to stir and continue those efforts to cool that perimeter and slow that progression.
Yeah, a lot of hard work going into that fire. What's the current level of threat to Hennifer, which has been under evacuation?
Honestly, today is obviously not as high as it has been, but that's where tomorrow's really going to be kind of the telling part of where it is because there's still a lot of heat up in those cliffs above Hennifer. And while residents are looking at the mountain today and seeing no heat and no flames like they have been the last few days and thinking that it's safe to go home, you know, all it takes is one day, I think by tomorrow morning, as soon as the sun is out, you will already start to see heat. And where we've seen sparks flying miles, all it takes is one little wind shift and one spark to land down in that valley. And it's the fires up, you know, up above those cliffs near that community. And that's some of the concern. It's not far from where they're at. And all it would take is one spark landing down there. And so until we have containment and we have cooled all of those heat sources up right directly above that community, there's still a threat there, and we'll start to see that again tomorrow.
Okay, makes sense. Yesterday we learned two small outbuildings were lost in the fire. Do you have any updates on any other structure loss?
There's no other structure loss at this time. Yeah, no primary structures lost. That was two sheds on a property. And thankfully, that's great considering the conditions we saw the first few days. But as of right now, we've been in, getting and able to assess almost all of the fire, and we believe that is the only loss.
Okay, great. And part of the reason homes are safe is because of homeowners creating some of that defensible space. Could you talk a little bit about that and how that helps crews?
Absolutely. A lot of times people think that what burns houses down in a fire is like a flame front moving through. And to be fair, we have seen that a couple times this year on Cottonwood, and the one structure we lost on Widemouth while we were down there, it was contiguous vegetation that was burning hot and burned through. But the more likely candidate of losing a home is actually sparks landing on your property. And so not even just with this fire, but we live in wildland urban interface where fires are part of the existence here in the West. And so some of the actions people can take is, you know, you can always go to firewise.gov, firewise.org, and look up how to have defensible space. But some things that residents can do now to protect themselves is making sure you have any dead trees cut down, that no vegetation is touching your house, making sure you're cleaning your gutters out, and any needles or any dead fuels or vegetation on the ground, not having any log piles in or near any structures, anywhere where an ash could fall and spark a fire. And with everything as dry as it is, it's not going to take much. So those are some simple actions that you can take right now while the threat isn't immediate and we've got a little bit of weather on our hands to help us out. But really, the best way to protect your home is to be proactive and have defensible space.
Yeah, so it really does make a difference, that defensible space. Yeah. I believe you've been working in wildland fires for a decent amount of time now. I'm curious how fires have changed in your time in this work. How is climate change kind of shaping fire behavior from what you've observed?
Yeah, I've been with the Forest Service about 22 years, and fires are definitely, you can look at the statistics, you can look at the numbers. It's not an opinion. The science is there that fires are getting bigger, they're getting hotter, they're getting stronger, and even the temperatures that we've seen, we've seen record high temperatures almost all summer long here in Utah. I think Salt Lake hit its record high. Most of northern Utah did, southern Utah did. When you're hitting records like that, along with a multi-year drought and then our lowest snowpack on record, all of those data points are what's subject to kind of one of the worst fire seasons Utah has seen.
And I know that many people ask how they can support firefighters during fire season. Do you have any thoughts on what's helpful and maybe what's not?
Absolutely. It's one of those, the hardest thing for me is when people want to help, just saying, no, we have everything we need. And genuinely, we have a great logistics staff here with our team that we have food coming daily. We get hot meals twice a day, breakfast and dinner. We have sack lunches. And, you know, the firefighters up hiking the mountain every day, they have a 4,000 calorie meal count that we try and get to them because of how hard they're working and that they need that to keep their sustaining of their energy up there. So we have that all coming in. We've got water, we've got Gatorade, and then we put supply orders in that get brought up from town every day, that's our chainsaw parts and our hose lay and all of the things that we need. So really where your money and your efforts are best suited are, you know, your local volunteer and county fire departments are here too. And they aren't always as highly funded. And those are people donating their time sometimes. And so we always recommend, like, support the people that are out here helping us that are your local firefighters, the local men and women, giving their time to be here and help save your communities. Take any either food or monetary donations to them. Some other options are the Wildland Firefighter Foundation. And that's a foundation. It's a private entity. So I'm not in any way endorsing a specific one, but that one particularly, they will help take care of families or firefighters that have been injured. They'll help fly families to where their loved ones passed away. If we lost firefighters, they'll help support families through the health crises on top of maybe what the government or whoever paying their bills are. And they're just really supportive to injured and deceased firefighters. And where we've lost a couple this year, groups like that really make a difference. And then lastly, the signs around the communities. I know it seems small and probably seems insignificant, but I don't know a single firefighter that doesn't just get a little bit choked up when they see those signs hanging on the fences and around the communities as we're driving up to fight this fire every day.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. Thanks for keeping us in the loop throughout this fire. Is there anything else that you want to add or share with residents before I let you go?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is this fire is going to be deceptive. We got rain and people are going to think it's out, but heat sits in those stumps, heat sits in those trees, heat sits in that heavy fuel. And all it's going to take is a little heat on this to heat it back up and, you know, a little bit of sunshine, and this thing is going to be going again. And so that fire scar is closed for a reason. I never want to make a point out about someone who was injured, but we had a fire over in Nevada, and I don't know all the details, but two civilians went into the fire scar and were injured yesterday. And I don't know details of their status, but there is a reason that we're asking the public to stay out. It may look cool and calm, but there's still so much heat in there. When we have our infrared flight, even overnight when we're seeing the rain and stuff like that, there's a lot of heat on this mountain. So please stay out. It weighs heavy on our hearts when we get injured, but it is incredibly difficult when a member of the public is injured on our watch.
Yeah, thank you for that reminder. That's all we have time for this morning. But Sierra, thank you so much for being here. And thanks to the whole team fighting the Rocky Canyon fire.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Sierra Hellstrom of the U.S. Forest Service. You're listening to KPCW Park City. We'll be right back. During its meeting today, the Park City Council will look into bringing a regional public safety facility to the area. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the council will also decide on Little Cate Road upgrades.
After a brief summer break, the Park City Council is returning to regular meetings Thursday. The first item on the agenda is an update on a regional emergency operations center. With Park City continuing to grow and emergency response demands changing, the police department identified a future need for such a center. City Manager Adam Lenhardt said the facility would increase the region's ability to respond to large-scale incidents and support daily operations.
There are some potential functions that could include emergency operations, incident command, emergency supply distribution, family reunification, triage, staging, public safety training, multi-jurisdictional coordination.
The discussion is in its early stages and coincidentally coincides with the Rocky Canyon fire burning in Summit and Morgan counties. Also Thursday, the council will decide how to upgrade Little Cate Road. Staff is recommending residents' favorite option, which has the fewest changes. It includes painted and buffered bike lanes with an expanded sidewalk. Deputy City Manager Heather Sneddon said the council will also consider traffic calming measures like median islands and traffic circles, as well as safety enhancements. Sneddon said the project will then move to the design phase, which will include more public comment opportunities. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, here in the studio with me is Midway City Council Member Kevin Payne. Kevin, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. We're here to talk mostly about affordable housing. I know the council has been looking at a couple of projects in kind of in the core of Midway recently. For our listeners who don't follow city news as closely, could you kind of share an overview of what's included in those projects?
Well, yeah, we have two projects. One of them is an existing building with a basement that has space for an additional potentially six units. Current zoning does not allow the additional units, and so that's something that we're discussing right now to see whether we can make something like that work for affordable rental apartments.
Mm-hmm. And I believe there was another proposal, it's maybe in earlier phases, but another proposal not too far from that basement one as well.
Yes, that's another one that's a complete new construction that they are proposing. Overall, it includes commercial, some short-term rental units, and then they're also proposing in the back a number of affordable units.
Okay. What do you think the council's instinct is on it? Are people generally pretty supportive? Do they have concerns?
Yeah, I think generally they're supportive. They'd like to see something happen there. At the same time, I think we need to look at it from the perspective of to make sure that this is really going to be truly affordable, mm-hmm. not specific to these two projects. I've been on currently on the Wasatch Affordable Housing Board and seen a lot of projects throughout the county come before us. And unfortunately, it's very easy to see kind of developers that are focusing on providing, wanting to provide some affordable housing, but is it truly affordable housing? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, in Midway, I think we want to see truly affordable housing and not just in name only.
Yeah. One thing I've heard people talk about up here in Park City, where there's also kind of an affordable housing challenge, is setting the rent based on workforce wages rather than the area median income. Is that some, I'm curious where you stand on an approach like that.
Well, that's definitely the, Summit County has the same issue the Wasatch mm-hmm. County has. It has a very high area median income mm-hmm. and state law determines, or basically state law says that 80% of the median income and below, that's going to be affordable. Unfortunately, high income counties like Summit and Wasatch, that's really not affordable at mm-hmm. all, especially in the rental market. I would venture to say 70% of the area median income is not affordable, and in some cases 60% is not affordable.
Yeah. So then what do you do? How do you solve that problem?
Well, I think you need to be aware of that instead and really look at what is the end resulting rent that a tenant's going to pay. And to your point in terms of like service sector jobs or whatever, that's the key, one of the key components and problems. Another thing I think it's too easy for us as citizens that live in these communities to sit back and say, that's the developer's responsibility to provide affordable housing. Mm-hmm. When all of us go shopping at a grocery store, all of us go to restaurants, all of us patronize businesses that have service workers mm-hmm. that can't afford to live in our county,
yeah.
for that matter. And so we all contribute to affordable housing. I think ideally, we should all be contributing to the solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do we know about the need for affordable or workforce housing in Midway? How many of your workers are commuting in from outside the community?
There have been surveys done that kind of generically try and establish that, but there isn't an actual number that pinpoints that. There's definitely the service sector jobs in Midway, in all of Heber Valley. A good majority, I would venture to say 70% or more, are coming up from probably Utah County.
Wow, that's a huge percentage.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure that plays into, you know, other things that the community then needs to deal with, like traffic and parking and things that I hear the mayor and council members talk about often.
Correct. I mean, it's a multifaceted issue that touches everything.
Yeah. We're talking right now, you know, this basement proposal is, I believe, a half dozen units. So it's a few units here, a few units there. From your perspective, a few years from now, what would a good and sustainable, like, overall plan for affordable housing look like for the community?
So to me, there's some key components for ensuring affordability. What ends up happening most times is when developers are, and I'm just saying generically, when they're coming in and doing their proposal, whether it's apartments, whether it's for sale, and asking for density bonuses under the guise of, we're going to give you some affordable housing, there's some key components to really deliver true affordable housing. One is, if it's rental, the rental rate. I mean, it's got to be truly affordable versus market rate. Mm-hmm. And that's the issue of, you know, the state gives you credit at 80%, and because of our high median incomes, that's way above market. So one, is it truly affordable? Two, it needs to be long-term. Mm. I've seen provisions where after 3 years, you know, the affordability component goes away. Mm. I think 10 years and 20 years is way too short. Programs I've been involved in, they're up to 55 plus years mm-hmm. in terms of affordability. So I don't think we want to go through all the exercise of because it's very difficult to create some affordable housing only to have it disappear. And then there's other components, like we need to make sure that it's being rented, if it's rental, or sold to those at certain income levels. If there isn't income restrictions on those that are occupying, then it's not really going to who it really should be going for. The last thing we want to do is provide an affordable unit and rent it to someone who's making $150,000 a year.
Makes sense. Yeah. Where does something like transit fit into the picture? You know, in Heber City, down the road from you, I hear people talk a lot about, you know, affordable housing belongs near bus stops and other services that, you know, it's not just housing that people need, it's other resources to be able to live in an expensive community. DC Midway ever add in something like transit to support workers?
Well, the one thing, the unique thing, I guess, with Midway versus, say, Heber City is we don't have a highway that, you know, heavy traffic is going through versus, say, 40.
True.
So that's always going to make this a little bit different. Affordable housing in general, especially the rental affordable housing that addresses the lower threshold, you know, workers like service workers. Yes, you'd like to have those near, you know, transportation centers and whatnot, and closer to the, you know, amenities from schools to shopping to grocery stores and things like that that they patron. And there's programs, as you know, the LIHTC program kind of encourages developments that would be located near those type of facilities. That's the only thing that really has the strings attached, if you will, to make sure or try and ensure that.
Yeah.
Other than that, there's no other programs that kind of tie your hands that way.
Understood. Yeah. You mentioned LIHTC, which is the low-income housing tax credit. Did
Correct.
I get the acronym right?
Correct.
And you have professional expertise in this. What's it like to bring that professional background to the council?
I'll just say in general, not just to the council, but in general, it's kind of a little bit of a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. Without the knowledge and understanding of all the intricacies of what goes into affordable housing and how it's financed and whatnot, and I'm speaking as a developer that has done this, I've seen, for example, in the Housing Authority, the developers coming in and making proposals, and I could quickly say, that's not going to work, or that's not going to be affordable. And without that deep knowledge and understanding, it's very easy for others to kind of look at that and think, oh, we're getting truly affordable housing, when they're not.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. Thanks for explaining that. Yeah. What are the next steps with the small projects that have been brought to the council so far?
So those two projects are unique. I mean, right now, and Midway did this for a reason, is in the downtown area, in our C2 and C3 zoning, you're only allowed one unit per acre. They used to be allowed up to 20 in addition to the commercial square footage that they were allowed, which allowed very high density. We have one development that's building for sale units under that guise, and that higher density didn't provide any affordable housing. Mm-hmm. It provided units that are selling in the $2 million plus range.
Wow.
So density doesn't just get you affordability in and of itself without restrictions on that. So we downzone that, you know, throughout the C2 zoning to one unit per acre. Mm-hmm. To enable us, if people come in and have proposals, we can through a development legislative agreement, give them additional density, as long as it's deed restricted, truly affordable, and in my mind, needs to be, you know, long term.
Yeah, so it sounds like there are going to be some careful conversations that need to happen.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. In our last couple of minutes, I want to move on to a slightly different topic. I know you have a grant to use up for the town square by December, I think. Does the city know yet how it would like to spend that money?
We are feverishly working to accommodate that and work and make that happen, yes, because we absolutely want to take advantage of any of the grants that we have received.
Yeah. What's the overall vision for the town square?
Well, we have an overall kind of, you know, master plan and vision. I think what goes hand in hand with that is, okay, what are going to be the priorities and focus on those, and especially when you have grants that are going to expire, that's going to push, I think, the priorities to those particular items that you need to spend the money on. So it's a work in progress, and we're feverishly trying to make that happen.
Yeah. Is that separate from I heard recently about the Utah Main Street program, that Park City and Midway were participating in that. It sounds like this is a different program.
It's a different grant. So there's a number of grants that, you know, we've been working with. So yes.
Yeah. There's a lot that goes on in the town square, especially this time of year, I feel. Although the ice rink in the winter, yeah, it's really a year round spot for the town.
Yes.
Yeah. And you're on the city's open space committee. Do you have any updates on projects there? I know we heard from Wendy Fisher a couple of meetings ago. Are there any open space projects in the works?
There's a number of projects. I mean, the good news is the first open space bond that we did, that was a total of $5 million. Mm. The last project, I think, is utilizing the remainder of those funds. So with a handful of projects that are kind of in the pipeline, if you will, these take a long time, as you know. It could be, you know, a number of years to get them consummated. But that's playing out just perfectly, I think, in my mind, in terms of the second bond measure that was passed by the voters for an additional $5 million that we can hold off selling those bonds, incurring any interest until we're ready with another slew of projects that are ready for those funds.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Did you have something else to add?
No.
Okay, all right. Well, I know it seems like you're busy on a lot of fronts in Midway. Is there anything else you would really like listeners to know about that's coming up in town?
At the moment, no. I mean, we do have Swiss Days coming up, which is big for Midway, and I know the community as a whole works very hard to make that a success.
Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to it.
All right.
Kevin, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you again for coming up to the station.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Grace. Thank you.
We've been talking with Midway City Councilmember Kevin Payne. You're listening to KPCW. We'll be right back. On the phone with me is Summit County Councilmember Candace Hart. Candace, how are you?
Great. Thank you very much. And good morning, Grace.
Good morning to you. Thank you so much for being here. I want to start briefly with the Rocky Canyon fire that's burning in your county. I know that you're involved in search and rescue. Have you been involved in the wildfire response at all?
Yes, search and rescue was part of the evacuation of Hennifer. So I work for the sheriff's office. And so everything search and rescue does is part of the sheriff's office. So once the sheriff made the decision to go for the evacuation, we paged out search and rescue members and they responded. And we coordinated that effort with the sheriff's deputies. And it was a combined effort of really Summit County Sheriff, Morgan County Sheriff, Highway Patrol, and search and rescue that executed the evacuation order.
Okay. What goes into executing something like that?
It's actually fairly well choreographed, so not to make it anticlimactic, but once that decision happens, once the sheriff in coordination with the incident command post makes that decision, then really we have areas assigned. So it could be like, just imagine a city block. It's not quite like that, but you know, a deputy and a search and rescue member, as an example, would be assigned one of these areas. And they literally go to that area. It's geofenced in so we can see where they're moving. They knock on every door and they personally deliver the evacuation message. Residents at the end of the day can decide what they want to do for themselves, whether they stay or go. But every home, we can assure, was knocked on or contacted at least once.
Wow. This one, it seems like maybe there was a little bit more lead time, but I imagine that kind of situation can evolve really, really quickly.
Yes. Luckily, though, even before I think this fire was on the radar of Summit County residents, Summit County Emergency Manager Catherine McMullen and the sheriff and the chief deputy and, you know, that command team were already working it. So I think this goes back to like Friday or Saturday. They were already thinking about it. And so things like this evacuation plan were actually built or created before what was actually needed. So that's why I say when the actual execution order came, the go order, it was actually rather easy. It was already pre-planned at that point.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, it's good that you have the plan in place before you actually need it.
Yes, yeah, hopefully, yeah.
Yeah. What's your impression? Have many people chosen to stay in Hennifer?
I think a decent amount stayed. You know, personally, I was evacuated during the Parley's fire. My family had to be out of our house for, I think it was 4 days. I can tell you from my own experience, you know, and I know the sheriff does not take that decision lightly to choose to evacuate or not, because honestly, like for us, I think the first day maybe is a little bit adventurous, but by day two, it gets a little old. And by day three and four, you're really just really itching to get back home. Yeah. So, you know, for those residents that choose to stay home, I mean, it's a personal choice. We don't think too much into it. We just want to make sure that everybody's safe. So we just really try to contact them and give them the choice.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that update from up in the Hennifer area. Shall we talk a little bit about government?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so last night I tuned into the interlocal meeting with Wasatch County. You haven't had too many of these in the past few years. Why? What made the counties start meeting again?
We've got a few things we're working on, even besides the like specifics of why we had that meeting, which I'll touch on, but big picture, really the Wasatch Back is becoming more unified in what its wants and needs are and what these various development pressures are. So Wasatch County and Summit County are much more aligned today than they used to be in what's happening and affecting us. County population is roughly about the same. I wouldn't be surprised if Wasatch County isn't bigger than us at the next census. Lots of development in Wasatch County happens right on the border of Summit County. When we think about, like last night, we spoke with Caroline Rodriguez, the executive director of High Valley Transit, because that is the regional transit provider for all of us here in the Wasatch Back, and they run transit into Wasatch County and Summit County. So we wanted to hear that collectively. And then the county manager for Wasatch County brought up the topic of everybody's favorite thing, which is really, I say in jest because none of us like it, but the idea of a preliminary municipality. And so we're aligned on an issue like that. And so to your point, yeah, we haven't had too many of them. We're starting to have them now. And it's really just about trying to coordinate better.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let's get into a little bit with each of those issues you just named. As far as transit goes, did anything surprise you in Caroline's presentation?
I don't think anything surprised me. I've been around the transit conversations quite a bit. We have council members that are on the board of High Valley Transit. We don't have the majority and we don't manage High Valley Transit. They're an independent district, but we have people in place that, you know, keep us apprised of what's happening. One of the things that's more, maybe not interesting, but the development is in Wasatch County, or I should say High Valley Transit launched in Summit County first, and then it went into Wasatch County. So it was kind of a newer thing. I guess the other thing is High Valley's only been around 5 years. So for context, it's a relatively short period of time for everybody, but Summit County was first and then Wasatch County came in a bit after. So it's interesting when we're in these joint meetings to hear kind of what Wasatch County's experience is and what they're thinking about and kind of how they see their future around transit. High Valley runs some buses down Parley's Canyon, down into Salt Lake. Well, Wasatch County really wants the same thing in Provo Canyon. Mm-hmm. It was interesting to hear Caroline say that to do that, they need a hub or some sort of, I don't think it'd be like a depot, but they need a place so they can charge all their buses and stuff like up there in Wasatch County. So those are some of the things we were learning, and it just kind of gives us a fuller picture of what High Valley's up to and what they're looking to do as they go in the future.
Yeah. What does High Valley Transit need to reach those goals?
I think, and you know, there's probably a lot more to this, but generally speaking, they need the support of, you know, really the Wasatch and Summit County councils. Like I said, we don't govern it, but we, you know, greatly can influence what does or doesn't happen. And I think if they have support from Wasatch County to do something, High Valley Transit would be really responsive and do that. So I think mostly right now they're just building support, and there's also like still an awareness campaign, even in the public. So they understand what microtransit is versus what a fixed line is and paratransit and how these things work. And people are adapting. That was one of the messages we heard, is that the teenagers have figured a lot of this out rather quickly. And I noticed the same thing with my own teenagers. They figured out High Valley Transit, microtransit really quick. So that apparently is happening in Wasatch County too, so no surprise. But they move a lot of, like, say, senior citizens around, and they have a senior center, and they're going to have a senior festival. And so it's really going to be, High Valley will be out at that festival explaining how people can use the bus, because not everybody likes to use an app. And interestingly enough, High Valley keeps a person on staff during, I forget the hours, but it's like really early in the morning to later in the evening. Mm-hmm. So if someone isn't comfortable using technology or an app, they can just make a phone call and they'll schedule a ride for them.
Okay. Yeah. I know that some of the Wasatch County residents, when that county was first starting to provide a little bit of funding to High Valley Transit, there was some hesitancy there and maybe some people disagreed with that. Do you see any similar hesitancy in Summit County?
No, there is. I mean, I'll talk to some people, and some of it's just philosophical. Like, you know, it might be just a different approach to governance, but some people just don't think it's you know, they don't want any of their tax dollars going to anything like that. And some are really excited about it. So it's like you would expect. You're going to have just a total mix of people and opinions, but it's subjective. So it's not that there's a right or wrong answer. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion. From a leadership perspective, what our goal is to provide transportation solutions to people. So really, how do you get to the doctor's appointment? How do we keep seniors to where they can get out of their homes and get to like public engagements and events? How do we get high school kids maybe around? You know, it's like safely, it's just how do you provide safe transportation so people can move around? Mm-hmm. And that's where our focus is at.
Yeah. Let's spend a couple of minutes on preliminary municipalities.
Let's just bash it for like as long as we can go here.
you talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Wasatch County is floating some inter-county resolutions or pressure on lawmakers to kind of amend this pilot program. What's your take on that?
Well, I think what I heard last night, and we didn't take a formal action or a formal vote, so you can't, like, we can't like technically say the council thinks one thing or the other yet. But what I heard though is unanimous support for what Wasatch County's doing, and if anything, we are encouraging the idea of, because we believe Morgan County is in the same mindset as Wasatch County and Summit County, that we're very much opposed to the idea of preliminary municipalities, and we think that a unified Wasatch-backed voice would be very helpful in the conversation. So we were just sort of Dustin, the county manager for Wasatch County, was floating the idea, and we're receptive to it. You know, what if we created our own response, and then what if we created a Wasatch back, you know, response? And so I think that's kind of what everybody was thinking. But and I should say, for anybody who doesn't know what we're talking about with preliminary municipalities, there's a thing in the state that the state legislature made where only two applications a year can be accepted, but a developer who, and I forget some of the specifics now, it's been a while since it's been around, but it's like three or less people, investors involved in the property. Mm-hmm. It's a certain size property, and if it isn't built on, they can declare they're going to build a city, like a preliminary municipality. And if they do that and their application is accepted, and this happened down outside of Moab in Grand County is a good example, then they can just build what they want because they're a city, so they'd make their own development code. So the density, the heights, whatever they want, the taxing would stay in there. They've basically can form a city any place they want in a county without the county having any say. And then the kind of crazier part of the whole thing is, they can build all of it and then decide the city isn't going to work. And they can just say, you know what, we're not going to go forward with the city after everything's been built, and then give it to the county to have to deal with. So you might imagine, I can't imagine really any county that would be supportive of this.
Yeah, and this seems like it's really where counties are getting concerned is that, yeah, they'll be left with the consequences if a town doesn't work out.
Absolutely. You know, and if town doesn't work out, the county would end up getting the tax revenue from it. But, you know, counties, we have general plans. We have ideas where we want to build growth or where we want residents or where you want commercial. You know, you were where, in our case, Summit County, we do a great job preserving open space. So when you have a preliminary municipality that can ignore all of that and just build what they want, where they want, it can really, in our minds, maybe it's in a strong word, but wreak havoc on these general plans and on what our intention is or what we're trying to do. So that's why I can't imagine any county that would be supportive of this. And, you know, not to be a fearful person per se, but, you know, I'm always afraid that the state may decide they like this and they want to expand the number. So maybe it's more than two a year. Maybe they increase it. I don't know, but we see development pressure. We already have people trying to build in Browns Canyon. We have them trying to build up along Wanship and Colville and, you know, these areas. So we see nothing but more pressure, but we think we should be able to have self-rule and manage our land ourselves.
Yeah. Candace, that 15 minutes went really fast. Out of time. But thank you for your perspective, and we'll be looking forward to seeing what the county does next with this conversation.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. And if anybody ever has a question for council, you can always email us. We're really good at responding, or we try to be, and we'll get back to you as soon as we can. So thank you, everybody.
Awesome. Candace, thank you so much for joining the show.
Okay, bye.
That was Summit County Council Member Candace Hart with an update on a joint meeting with Wasatch County last night. You're listening to KBCW. You have been listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Grace Dorfler. I've been filling in for Leslie Thatcher as your host this morning. You can find your local news online anytime at kbcw.org.